Okay, good morning, ladies, and welcome to our annual, welcome me, I guess, you've been at it all morning, but the annual Health and Halacha Day, and I want to express gratitude to the amazing chairwomen who put together another enormously successful event. I hope you are learning, enjoying, and I know you're in for a great lunch, honoring three really deserving honorees, so thank you for being here this morning. The topic this morning we began to discuss on Simchas Torah. For some of you, this will be a little bit of a review, an expanded version of that class, and a little bit more in depth and a little bit of a slower pace. It's something that affects, I would really say, all of us all the time, because if you're a thinking and caring person, then almost by definition you are around somebody who's in pain. It's almost impossible to be alive, to be connected with others, to be a member of a family, to have friends, to identify with a community, and to not have the opportunity to be a good friend. Our topic is how to be a good friend to someone who's in crisis. Crisis could mean different things for different people. I'll never forget when I was in Yeshiva University Rabbinical School, and we had a teacher of pastoral counseling, Dr. Irving Levitz, and he taught a class on pastoral counseling. It was before the modern day Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future, where the whole curriculum has really been transformed, a lot more emphasis on this. In those days, we got a lot about how to salt the chicken. We didn't get a lot about how to interact with people. But this was one, the beginning really of that, and he taught us a class. And he explained to us, he showed us, how as a rabbi, just like as a therapist, it is easy to sit in judgment. And he described a scenario where a woman came to meet to get therapy. This is a woman whose husband had passed away, whose child was diagnosed with a terrible illness. She herself had recently lost her job and had no income and threatened to be thrown out of her home. And every other scenario you can imagine, combining it to describe what must be the greatest crisis. And you sit for an hour trying to comfort and strengthen and guide and direct and uplift this woman to be able to persevere through her challenges. The hour's up, which the therapist has the luxury of saying, and therefore pay on your way out, it's time to leave. And the next appointment comes in. And the next appointment is a man who's wearing a $5,000 suit and a $25,000 watch. And he sits on the couch and he begins to cry. And he tells the therapist, "Why am I so sad? Because I live in the shadow of my brother. My brother makes $50 million a year. He's the apple of my parents' eye. He's the pride of our family. And I, Nebuch, make $5 million a year. I'm a failure, I'm in nothing, I'm worthless, nobody respects me, nobody admires me, nobody loves me, I have no self-esteem, I have no self-worth." So Dr. Levitz turned to us, a group of young rabbinical students, and said, "What are you tempted to tell him? What are you tempted to say to him? Are you out of your mind? You moron, do you know who sat in this chair just a few minutes ago? Do you understand where your problems rate in comparison to the real problems that are out there?" And he taught me a lesson that has stuck with me as a human being, let alone as a rabbi, ever since. He said, "You know, communicating that to that man will accomplish only one goal. You'll make him feel guilty about feeling bad, but you won't make him feel better. Because his problem is his problem. The individual can say, 'You know, I find comfort, or I'm uplifted, or I'm able to find strength to overcome my problem,' by realizing that in the context of problems, it's nothing. That's for us to say for ourselves. But vis-a-vis others, no one is entitled to tell someone else that their problem is insignificant, inconsequential, that it's negligible. We can draw that conclusion to find strength for ourselves. We're not entitled to tell that to other people. Because when you say that to someone else, aside from being horribly insensitive and defensive, all you do is make the other person feel bad about feeling bad, but you don't make them feel better." And I say that as an introduction to our definition of what does it mean to have a friend in crisis. Some friends in crisis is because they have a terminal diagnosis or a diagnosis of a disease which is irreversible, that has a trajectory for a horrific life to come. Some a crisis is suffering a tragedy with a child, struggling with infertility, the loneliness of desperately wanting to be married. I think things that we would all legitimately rate as valid crises. But you might have a friend call you because her crisis is that she chipped her nail. And she was supposed to go somewhere and the nails needed to be perfect and she stubbed her toe. Her husband only makes $5 million a year, but she thought she was marrying someone who would make $50 million a year, in the words of Dr. Lovitz. And I don't mean to suggest that we need to give the same attention and love and support to the stubbed toe or the chipped nail, but I mean to say that we will not do well to sit in judgment of other people's crisis. That's not what it means to be a good friend. That's not our role. People need to draw conclusions on their own and sense with a great sense of appreciation, right? The famous, if everybody had an opportunity to walk into a room and put their peckle on the table, their problems, their challenges, and walk around and see the others, they pick theirs up and walk out. We'd all take our own. But that's a conclusion we draw. We're not entitled to tell someone else, you think you have a peckle? You think you have a problem? Let me tell you about a problem. So the first lesson of being a good friend to someone in crisis is to not make them feel bad about feeling bad, but to try to understand where they're coming from and feeling bad and help them feel better. That's the first mission. So what I want to talk about is really what I think is the critical value or characteristic, the most important trait to continue to cultivate within ourselves. For some people, it's to continue to try to perfect it. For others, it's to introduce it into their portfolio of character traits. And that is the character trait of empathy. Not of sympathy, but of empathy. We're going to see a short video momentarily about the difference between the two. But empathy means not only feeling bad for you, but feeling bad with you. Having a feeling heart, connecting with the pain of another, and wanting to solve that pain, not only to give that person relief, but by extension, to gain relief yourself. Because that person's pain is causing you pain, and you too need relief. And I want to see this through a number of Torah sources together. So let's start with source number one, which is always a good place to start. You have an outline of the class on page 2. If you want to be able to look at it, review it afterwards. And we begin with the sources on page 3. Pasuk says, Vayashkim Avram baboker vayikach lechem v'chemas mayim v'yiten al agar sam al shechma v'esayelet v'yishacheha. We recently read the story of our patriarchs and matriarchs, and we remember how Avram, who was a loving father and for whom this does not come easy, but because Hashem told him something which Jewish men have been instructed ever since, whatever your wife tells you, Tishma Bikola, listen to her voice. Whoever thinks that Judaism is gender bias is absolutely correct. It's not the gender they think. Because Judaism sets up a paradigm that if one has to defer to the other, the real authority, particularly at least internally within family matters, Tishma Bikola, your wife has an intuition, she has an innate wisdom, listen to her. She knows what she's talking about. So Avraham, the great prophet, Avraham, the great father of the Jewish people, Avraham on the soapbox and writing op-eds, who's transforming the world radically with ethical monotheism, is told, you need to quiet what you think is right, and listen to your wife. And what did his wife think was right? Sarah says Yishmael is not a good influence. It's time to kick him out. Yishmael needs to go for a break. So Avram sends Hagar, Yishmael's mother, his original, or at least the woman who originally bore him a child, and sends them packing, literally on their way. And the water was gone. So what did Hagar do when they ran out of water? She withdrew from her son Yishmael. What did she do? They ran out of provisions. They ran out of food. They ran out of water. They're in the hot sun, baking. And what does Hagar do? Not what we associate with a maternal instinct. She does the opposite. She says, you know, I can't bear to watch him suffer. And therefore, she withdraws. She doesn't hold him, she doesn't comfort him, she doesn't support him. She withdraws from him because she says, Al ereb b'mos hayeled, I can't stand to watch him suffer, so I need to pull away. I can't watch, I have to look away. And this is the opposite of empathy. This is learning by contrast. Hagar lacks this quality. What's the opposite of empathy, as depicted in the story with Hagar, is it's downright cruel. It's cruelty. What mother can watch their child begin to diminish, begin to perish, and say, not only will I not do all I can to intercede, to hold, to usher him in his transition from this world, but I can't bear to watch. What's at the root of such an attitude is selfishness. And while we read this story and say, I can't identify with that, either as a parent or a friend or a child, I would never withdraw. I would be there by the bedside. I would be interceding in every way I could. The truth is, many people do this. And it's one of the first lessons of the wrong things to say, which is what we're going to come back to towards the end. They'll tell someone, thinking that they're offering comfort, but it's actually a cruel comment, to say, you know, I went to visit your husband, I went to visit your father, I went to saw your mother, and it broke my heart to see their suffering. I don't think I can go again. I walked out, I couldn't look, I couldn't stay, I went outside and cried. And somehow they think that they're communicating a sense of connection, or I relate to how hard this is for you, by suggesting, I can't watch, I can't bear to see it. But to say I can't bear to see it is not only not an act of kindness, it's an act of cruelty. Keep that thought to yourself. Work that through yourself. But Hagar lacks empathy. She in fact practices the exact opposite. It's cruelty. Someone who has empathy can't bear to turn away, and can't stop wanting to be there, can't stop wanting to look, feels something is missing or deficient if they're not at the bedside, every moment that they're not trying to help as much as they can. And this is what we see from our greatest leaders. Source 2, the Pasuk tells us, we know that when Amram and Yocheved make the incredibly difficult decision to put Moshe, little baby Moshe, in the basket, and let him float in the river, lest he be caught in their home and be put to death. So Paro's daughter, whose name is Bisya, often mispronounced as Basya, goes to bathe. Vatera es hateva besoch asuf, and she sees this basket with Moshe floating. Vateshlachas amasava tikacha. She extends her hand, which Chazal tell us stretched even further. This is a reminder that when you do chesed, when you have compassion, did her hand literally stretch? Are we meant to understand, where Chazal telling us that we have to believe that God suspended the rules of nature, that normally our hand is done growing, but she, miraculously, like Plastic Man, like, you know, some robotic figure, her arm stretched and stretched and stretched. I don't interpret Chazal to understand them in that. What I understand Chazal to be telling us is that when we are attuned to chesed, when we see someone suffering and we want to get involved, nothing is beyond our grasp. If we stretch, it's not beyond our grasp. We often say, I tried, there was nothing I can do. How hard did you really try? Were you satisfied or relieved to think that there was nothing you can do? Because if we are committed to do, then when we stretch, nothing is beyond our reach, nothing is beyond our grasp. She sees this baby floating, and she's not willing to walk away until she can get that basket and check out what's going on inside of it. And so, even though it might have at first been beyond her reach, I don't think Chazal were telling us her arm literally stretched. I understand it to mean that if you're really dedicated to something, you have divine assistance in being able to attain it. But tiftach v'tareu es hayeled, so she opens the basket and she checks out what's going on inside. So she looks at, what's inside the basket is described as a, it's not a trick question, you have the text in front of you, described as a v'tireu es hayeled. She looks inside the basket and she sees a yeled. What's a yeled? A child, a boy. Vihine na'ar boche. She looks and she sees the yeled. And what does she find? A na'ar, a lad, an adolescent crying. And her heart goes out. She takes pity on him. So Rashi says, who is inside the baby? Rashi notices a discrepancy. If you're paying close attention to the text, then what can you not help but notice? At first, what's described inside the basket is a yelled. And then literally, two words later, is a nar. So which is it? Who's in the basket? A yelled or a nar? Is this a baby? Is it a young man? So Rashi's bothered by this question. Every time Rashi makes a comment on Chumash, he's answering a question. He doesn't tell you the question. He gives the answer, and our job is to try to discover what was his question. Clearly that was his question. And what does Rashi answer in source 3? Vinei nar boche, kolo kina'ar. Moshe was unusual. His voice went deep right away when he was born. He sounded like a young man even though he was a baby. And says Rashi, that's how we reconcile this text. Was he a baby? Was he a young man? But the Balaturim, Yaakov ben Asher, has another comment. His insight is phenomenal. He says, you know, you're wondering, why is it a contradiction? What was in the basket, a baby or a young man? Says the Balaturim, we're not talking about the same thing. Inside the basket was a baby. Who says the Na'ar crying was inside the basket? Look at the Balaturim. V'nei nar boche ze aron she'nichasto eisal ateva. Nar boche begamatria ze aron akoin. You know who was crying? Not the baby, but hiding behind the bush, watching and staring at this basket floating in the river, unable to extract himself, unwilling to go back to his life, attached to the destiny, to what would be with this baby in the basket, was his older brother Aaron. So therefore, the daughter of Para Vatar Eyos Hayelet, she opens the basket and she sees a baby, v'hine nar boche, and behold, she hears the whimpering, the cries of a young man hiding behind the tree, looking behind the bush. Because Aaron, in great contradistinction to Hagar, Hagar says, I can't bear to watch, and Aaron says, I can't bear to look away. And what kind of friend are we? Do we can't bear to watch because it's all about us and our comfort and our feeling and how we're doing? Or are we the kind of friend who feels empathy? We're so attached to the plight and the pain of another that we can't bear to look away because we are in pain too. Because we are so committed to relieve them of that pain. So Aaron, the contrast of Hagar and Aaron, is the first contrast in empathy. But it's not just Moshe's older brother Aaron who has this character trait. It is Moshe himself. Source 5. Vayigboro so begei haaretz, beyei eretz Moav mu'a beis pa'or, v'layadu isha eskvura so ad hayom hazeh, Moshe ben me'a ve'esrim shona b'moso, lo ka'asa ino v'lo nas lecha. Moshe dies, and God is the only one who attends his funeral. God is the Chevra Kadisha, which is why the Chevra Kadisha celebrate their contributions on Zion Adar, the day of Moshe's Yuritzite, because that's the day they had off from work. Chevra Kadisha is busy every other day, but Moshe, God, was Moshe's Chevra Kadisha, so they had the day off, and that's the day designated to honor and recognize the contribution of the Chevra Kadisha. Moshe dies, and God is the only one there to bury him. God gives a hesped that nobody else hears. And God talks about Moshe's greatness. And what did God likely say? What distinguished Moshe? Why did God tap him to be the leader of the Jewish people? And not a leader in his time, a leader for all time. He is known in perpetuity as Moshe Rabbeinu. He remains our teacher today, long after he's gone. What made Moshe so great? Was it Moshe's brilliance? Was it Moshe's erudition, scholarship? Was it his memory? Was it his piety? What made Moshe so great? What did God likely speak about at the hesped that nobody heard? Source number 6. When Moshe, who has the privilege and luxury of being raised in the palace, right? Because the daughter of Paro sees the baby in the basket and hears his older brother crying and takes him the baby and raises him in the palace. She's the one who gives him the name that we know him by. Moshe had numerous names, but we call him Moshe. Moshe was not the name given by Yocheved and Amram. Moshe is not the name given by God. Moshe is the name given by the daughter of Paro. She really characterizes, because he was drawn forth from the water. His life is characterized by that act of kindness that she felt for him, in which her arm stretched. Again, not literally, but her arm stretched meant that when you care about other people, nothing is beyond your reach. Nothing is beyond your grasp. So he grows up in the palace, in the lap of luxury. He's not out there making bricks and building pyramids. He's not out there suffering. And yet, he can't take it. What would happen to Hagar? If Hagar had the privilege of living in the palace, she'd never look again outside. She would write off her heritage and where she came from because she'd say, I'm incredibly spoiled. I have the great privilege of growing up in the palace, but not Moshe. When God recruits Moshe to be the leader of the Jewish people, it says, God saw Kisar Liros. God saw that Moshe turned to look. So he called him. From where did he call him? From the burning bush. What happens? There's a bush. It's on fire. It's not being consumed. Which I think I once heard is a metaphor. Right? The symbol of Jewish leadership is a bush on fire that's not being consumed. Why is that the symbol of Jewish leadership? Because the message is that you can never burn out. You can't burn out. If you're dedicated to the mission, you cannot. You could tire. You could need to take a day off. The great Rabbi Tulishkin wrote a book about the Rebbe, Zatzal. One of the harshest parts for me about the book was when he describes that the Rebbe never took one day of vacation. Ever. Not one day. So the whole book I read, I said, I want to be like that, I want to be like that, I want to be like that. And then I got to that paragraph and I said, whoa, I can't be like that. Right? I actually have a taina on Rabbi Tolushkin for including it in the book because it makes it something unattainable, inaccessible. So if you're the Rebbe, you could never take not even one day off in your whole life. So you could take a day off, but you can never burn out. And that's not only true for rabbis, it's true for any position of leadership. It's true if you're involved in the Chesed Committee or the Biker Cholim or the Greed in the New Member Committee or whatever you're in, take a break, disconnect for a little bit and come back because you have to be on fire. The Jewish people needs it and you can't ever afford to burn out. That becomes the symbol. If I had to make a logo of Jewish leadership, it would be a bush on fire that's not being consumed. So everyone else is walking by this bush and Moshe is the one person who walks by and says, huh, something unusual going on here. And he stops to look. And that's the simple understanding of this verse. That God was impressed that while everyone else was probably texting while they were walking by, so they didn't see the bush on fire, everybody else was on the phone yapping, they didn't see the bush on fire, they were listening, they didn't see the bush on fire. Moshe is actually in tune and aware of his surroundings. He's connected to the natural world. And he says, wow, there's something unusual going on here. For us, an open miracle could happen right in front of our eyes, and we would bump into it because we're busy looking down at our phone and texting. And so Moshe understands. And the classic understanding is, why does God tap him? Why does he recruit him to be the leader? Because while everyone else is coasting through life, kind of what we spoke about yesterday with habits and routines and the need to interrupt them, Moshe does not get caught up in the habit and routine. He stops and he looks to see something unusual is going on here. But the Medrash says that's not what impressed God. Maybe others also noticed a bush that was on fire and not being consumed. What did Moshe see that nobody else saw? What did Moshe do that no one else did? So look at the Medrash Bamidbar Rabbah in source number 7. The Medrash describes that Moshe was 20 years old at the time, some say 40, when he was grown up. The Medrash goes on and on. And the Medrash tells us, go to the bottom. Vayara Hashem Kisar Leros, 3 lines from the bottom. The verse that we just read says, God notices that Moshe turns to look. What did he see? Ra HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'Moshe, shesar me'askav liros besiv losam. Lafichach vayikra ilav Elokim mitoch hasna. It's a play on words, says the Medrash. Where else did we see these words, sar liros? Where else did we see that Moshe stops to look? When he leaves the palace, Moshe could have hidden behind the walls of the palace. Moshe could have stayed on the compound of the palace. He was safe. He had luxury, delicacy. He was spoiled. But he couldn't help but go out. And why did he go out? He left Liros Pesiv Losam, to see their suffering. Empathy. He was connected to the plight, to the suffering of his fellow man. So, Vayara Shem Kisar Liros, says the Medrash, God saw that Moshe turned to look. Not that he turned to look at the bush, that he turned to look at his fellow man in pain. That's what impressed God. So you understand that Moshe is not recruited to be the leader of the Jewish people for all time because he's brilliant and because he's a scholar, because he's got the longest Shmona Esrei, because he never speaks Lashon Hara, because he's the most pious. Why is Moshe tapped to be the leader of the Jewish people? What is the quality of leadership? To feel the pain of another. He can't stand to be in the palace. He can't help but to be in the trenches, to see the pain, and that so impresses God. And where did Moshe learn that from? You know what Moshe saw in the bush? Source 8. Rashi tells us, why does God appear from a burning thorn bush? A thorn bush in the vegetative world, in the world of landscaping, is not the most beautiful bush, right? When you sat with your landscape architect to design your backyard, it's unlikely you said, I love thorn bushes. Let's put a few of them here, a few of them there. Mulch the thorn bush. Put the lighting on the thorn bush. The thorn bush is not the pinnacle of the landscaping world. Why did God appear from a thorn bush, a lowly bush that was burning but not being consumed? Why didn't he appear from a bed of roses? Why didn't he appear from a bougainvillea? I think I learned it since the Torah, the purple thing. Why didn't he appear from a beautiful bush? Says Rashi, Lo ilan acher mishum imo anochi betzara. Because God himself was communicating, the Jewish people are in pain, I'm in pain with them. Through World War I, the Chafetz Chaim didn't sleep with a pillow. He said, Jewish boys are out in war, I can't experience the same level of comfort and luxury. There are stories of great rabbis and of pious women who, when people around them were suffering, they deprived themselves of some of their usual comfort. Why? Because they said, how can I indulge in creature comforts when people are suffering? I want to experience a piece of their suffering. Now, you understand how bizarre and peculiar that is? How will my sleeping without a pillow help save boys who are at war risking their lives for me? How? It makes no sense. I'm not, okay, if I you know, work hard to raise money to buy them bulletproof vests, if I stop and I say Tehillim on their behalf, but to deprive myself of a pillow? There was a story in one of the Israel wars of a young girl who didn't eat ice cream as long as the war went on. She said, these boys are risking their lives, I can't eat ice cream. Well, how does it help them? The answer is it doesn't help them, but it helps them enormously. Because they know that while they're struggling, you're not business as usual. For somebody who's going through a difficult time, a friend in crisis, a real crisis, one of the biggest challenges is loneliness, is feeling invisible, is feeling irrelevant, is feeling insignificant, is wondering, does anyone notice, does anyone care? That my life and my day and every hour, you're a caretaker of a spouse who has a terrible illness, you have a child who you're worried about beyond belief, your life is absolutely turned upside down, abnormal. And the more that normal is going on around you, the more lonely you feel. And when someone communicates to you, as long as your life is not normal, neither will mine be. As long as your life is interrupted, as long as you have a new real, then mine is also different. Mine not having a pillow doesn't make your child better, but it makes you realize you're not alone, and that makes you and your child better. So God says, Imo Anochi Bitzara. One of the attributes of empathy is saying, you're not alone. I'm not business as usual. I'm not going on with life as if nothing's happening. I'm interrupting my life to help you realize that you are not alone. We try to do this regularly when we say a tefillah every Shabbos for the missing in action Israeli soldiers. And number 9 was a letter from the chief rabbi, Rabbi David Lau, who asked us, originally we said this, sheets on Simchas Torah, to dedicate one of the hakafos, and we did both at night and that morning, for these two heroes who gave their lives fighting in Gaza and whose bodies are still unjustly being held by Hamas, whose parents are tortured. The Golden spoke here, Hadar Golden's parents, and it's absolutely, every waking moment of their life is torture, is absolute torture, to think that they don't have a grave to visit, that their child's soul is not at peace and at rest because the body has not yet been buried. So how could we go on with life as usual? So this year, Hakafos, we're not the same Hakafos. For 6 Hakafos, it was the same festive Hakafos. And for 1, we thought about them. Imo Anochi Betzara. That these two families knew that Jews around the world were not business as usual, that we too felt your pain. So this quality is known by our rabbis as the quality of Nosei Ba'olam Chaveiro. Source 10. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the Braisa in Pirkei Avos, the 6th chapter, tells us there are 48 ways that we acquire Torah. There are 48 almost prerequisites or character traits. If you want to be a Torah personality, you have to be living these 48 qualities. And one of them, right above where I put the English words, in the middle of that line, is Nosei Ba'olam Chaveiro. What does that mean? To be Nosei Ba'ol means to carry the yoke, to carry the burden, im chavero, with your friend. And I always understood, and I understand this to mean the following. If your friend is walking by, and they're carrying something which is incredibly heavy, you say, wow, that looks awfully heavy. So they're crumbling, they're being crushed under the weight of that load. They're about to drop it. The sweat's pouring out from them. Their knees are buckling. And you as an observer say, wow, that looks really heavy. Are you a good friend? Right? You're a better friend than the person who didn't even look up from texting on their phone while they walked by. You at least validated them. You at least made them feel not invisible. You acknowledge that looks really heavy. But what would have made you an even better friend if you said, you know what, can I take part of that and carry it with you? And what happens when you run over and say, let me lift that with you? What happens for them? It feels lighter. It feels lighter. You can't necessarily help them put it down. Someone's burden can't be put down. A child, a spouse, a parent who's sick, financial, loneliness, desperate for a shidduch, desperately wanting a child, whatever the crisis of the day, you can't put the crisis down. But what you can do is say, move over, I want to lift that with you. And when you say move over, I want to lift it with you, for the person, it feels a little bit lighter. That's what our rabbis were teaching us, is that to be a Torah personality, you must be nosei be'ol im chavero. You can't just look and say, hey, that looks really heavy. And that's what most of us tend to do. I heard about your X, Y, or Z crisis. I'm so sorry to hear about that. It must be really hard. That's sympathy. Sympathy is, that looks really heavy. And that's nice. It's nice to be noticed. It's nice to have that validated or affirmed. But it's even nicer if they say, move over, I want to hold it with you. I'm going to lift it with you. Where can I hold on to it? Where can I lift it so that it becomes and feels a little bit lighter for you? So I want to share with you, based on yesterday's parsha, and I didn't mention the next whole section when we previously covered this. Anyone know which day on the Hebrew calendar Yosef was freed from prison? Yesterday we read about when Yosef went to prison, falsely accused. Anyone know which day he was freed from prison? He was freed on Rosh Hashanah. Source number 11, Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yudam and Beis tells us, "But Rosh Hashanah yatzah Yosef mibeis ha'asurim." That it was on Rosh Hashanah that Yosef went free, which is really appropriate because Rosh Hashanah is all about a day of new beginning, fresh start, a new opportunity. And Yosef found liberty. He was emancipated. He was freed from jail on Rosh Hashanah. It was a fresh start. Here's the question. How did Yosef go free? What caused Yosef's freedom? Did he have Nat Lewin or what's his name? Who's the great lawyer, the defense criminal attorney? Alan Dershowitz or Braffman, right? Did he have a world-class, world-famous lawyer, right? The glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, and Yosef, therefore, look, he left the garment, it doesn't fit, who knows did he have the best lawyer ever? No, was not a lawyer. Were there rallies and public campaigns and Facebook pages on behalf of Yosef? No. What was the catalyst for Yosef to go free? This is incredible insight. I love this insight. I wish I remembered where I first heard it, so I could give it its proper credit. You know where it is? We saw it in yesterday's parsha. What happens? Yosef had every right, sitting in prison, to hide in the corner, to cry, to wallow in his sorrows, to say, woe is me. Who cares about the world? Who cares about you? Who cares about your problems? Do you know my problems? And what are Yosef's problems? Here, the 17-year-old, stud, charismatic, brilliant, orator, dreamer, prophet, whose trajectory of life was the best of everything, overnight, thinking actually his father orchestrated it, is sent to go look on his brothers. The next thing you know, he's kidnapped, stripped naked, sold, attempted murder, instead, bottom of a pit with snakes and scorpions, lifted out of the pit, sold. You talk about the PTSD, the trauma that Yosef must have had. You talk about bullying, stripped naked, attempted murder, snakes and scorpions, sold into slavery. Now he's in a foreign land, thousands of miles from home, a new language, with no support system. But you know what he does? He doesn't say, woe is me. He rebuilds himself. He's in the house of Potiphar. He's in charge. And what does he do? Everything he does touches to gold. Everything he touches turns to gold. We spoke about it last week in the Parsha Shir and the Amun Shir. And why does it touch to gold? Because Shem Shemaim Shkur Bafiv, Yosef is the first Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. He talks about God all the time. All the time. He doesn't retreat. He doesn't say, woe is me. He says, wow, God, bring success, and God brings success. So Potiphar's home is exploding. His portfolio is through the roof. He's acquiring real estate. The field is growing. He's harvesting more volume than ever before. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Potiphar's wife accuses, she relentlessly pursues Yosef. Yosef finds the superhuman capacity to rebuff her provocation. And what's the result? Unjustly, false accusation, thrown in prison. If I'm Yosef, you know what I say in prison? To heck with everyone and to heck with God. I mean, how many chances am I going to give God? This is the result of being a God-centric person. This is the result of caring about people. I'm done dreaming. My life is a nightmare, not a dream. Here I am, alienated from my father, from my family, from my brothers. No one's looked for me. No one's come to reclaim me. When I try to rebuild, all that happens is I meet failure and I'm sitting in prison. So does Yosef retreat to the corner of his prison cell? And wallow, put his head in his lap, sit and cry, and say, woe is me, my life stinks, my life is terrible. You know what he does instead? Source 12. He looks up and he sees that he has two cellmates. His two cellmates are the Sara Mashkim and Sara Ofim, the baker and the wine bearer. Vayishal Srisei Paro Asher Ito B'Mishmar Beis Adonav Lemor, Madu Pnechem Ra'im Ayom. He says, brothers, what's with the long faces? Why are you so sad today? What's going on? And they say, really? You want to know how we're doing? So yeah, why do you look so sad? Okay, if you asked. We each had a pretty traumatic dream last night. We're pretty shaken from the dream. Yosef, dreams? That's my specialty. No problem. God has given me the ability to interpret it. Tell me your dream. Let me help you. Let me help you. You know what attained Yosef's freedom? You know what gave Yosef a Rosh Hashanah, a new beginning, a fresh start? Was not when he looked into his problems and his trials and his travails. It's when he looked at others and he said, Madu apneichem ra'im ayom? What's with the long face? Why are you so sad? What can I do to help you? Do you know what the answer is for us? The way we break out of our problems is by noticing the long faces of the people around us. This isn't just a vort on the parsha yesterday. This has been shown through research over and over and over again. People struggling with depression, for example. Not the insensitive use of the word depression that we all do. I'm so depressed. I'm depressed today. I'm depressed. A real clinical depression, which is a legitimate mental health illness, which often needs medication, needs therapy, needs to be addressed by all those means. But do you know therapy has shown over and research has shown over and over again that one of the best therapies with the highest success rate of breaking people out of that sense of depression is volunteering. It's volunteering. It's counterintuitive. I would think it's going to Nordstrom's. I would think it's a mani-pedi. I would think it's having a good steak and a glass of wine. I would think it's indulge in some pleasure, some hedonistic pursuit for yourself, and you'll break out of feeling depressed. But actually, the research all shows the exact opposite. That to break out of depression is not to care more about yourself, but to start caring about others. And the more that you volunteer, you give, you do for others, the better you'll feel about whatever you're going through. Google it. You'll see the research over and over. So Yosef does not sit in prison. And in fact, in Yosef's case, it's exactly what happens. Because he cared about other people, and when those other people or other person was freed, they remembered Yosef, he experiences his Rosh Hashanah, his fresh start, his new beginning, his new lease on life comes, not because he's wallowed in his own problems, but because he noticed the problems of others and he tried to bring them relief. He was dedicated to caring about other people. Whatever problems we think we're going through, I guess what I'm trying to communicate to you is, we should care about other people because we care about other people. But we should care about other people also because we care about ourselves. And one of the best ways to take care of ourselves is to take care of other people. It just happens to turn out that one of the best ways for self-care, one of the best ways for self-realization, actualization, whatever the catchphrase of the day, that one of the best ways for self-soothing is to take care of other people. So we should notice the long faces and the sadness and seek to provide relief and intercede on behalf of others because we care about them, but also because we care about being the best people ourselves. Reb Lachman from Keren B'Yavna was here for Shabbos. He told a story at Chalashudas. For whatever reason, he had to speak to his Rebbe, Rav Futner, about something that was bothering him, and Rav Futner shared with him a story about the Blush of a Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Spira, the hero of Yaffa Eliach, Aleh Shalom's amazing book, Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. So many of those incredible stories about the Blush of a Rebbe. So the Blush of a Rebbe was one of the heroes of Rav Futner. And Rav Futner said that when the Blush of a Rebbe was very sick, somebody called him and said, Rebbe, I want to do the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, I want to come visit you. And the Blush of a Rebbe heard it formulated in that way and said, thanks, but no thanks, I'm good. So the Chassid said, but Rebbe, I have a mitzvah, I want to do Bikur Cholim, I want to come visit you. He said, I'm good, go visit someone else. But Rebbe, I have a mitzvah, you're denying me the mitzvah, I want to do the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. The Blush of a Rebbe said, go somewhere else. So Rav Futner tried to explain, so the Blush of a Rebbe said to this young man, why am I telling you to go somewhere else? He said, listen, he said, you know, I don't want you to come visit me because I'm the object of your mitzvah. You want to shake a lulav and esrog, go buy a lulav and esrog. Don't turn me into your lulav and esrog. Don't turn me into your shofar. Don't turn me into your menorah, your chanukiah. I'm a person. You want to relate to me as a person? Relate to me as a person. Don't turn me into the mitzvah. A cheftza gavra. You're the gavra. I'm the cheftza of your mitzvah. So Rav Futner explained it to Rav Blachman. What was the Blush of a Rebbe saying? It's an entirely different way to look at the mitzvah. It's an incredible chiddush. The mitzvah of Bikur Cholim or Nicham Aveilim, visiting the sick, comforting the mourner, giving charity, doing chesed, the mitzvah is not the act. You know what the mitzvah is? The mitzvah is transforming yourself into the personality who's drawn to do the act. So the mitzvah Bikur Cholim is not saying, you're sick, when can I come? Because on my agenda of the day, I got to put on tefillin, daven, shacharis, give it to start, learn the daf, and I got to do Bikur Cholim check. So when are you free? The mitzvah is not Bikur Cholim check. The mitzvah is to become an empathetic person who intuits, who's drawn, who instinctively sees someone in pain and wants to help. That's the mitzvah. You don't pay a shiva call because it's on my list of things to do today, check shiva call. You pay a shiva call because somebody suffered a loss and my mere presence, even in silence, can help them feel more strength, to feel comfort. I want the mitzvah is to be the type of person who does these things. It's an entirely different way. This is what the Chazon Ish writes in Source 13, in Igros Chazon Ish, in the Chazon Ish's letters. He writes this amazing letter I came across. He says, Chazal lecha hergesh shel hishtatfus b'tzar zu lasecha. You're lacking a sense of feeling the pain of others. The solution is to work to benefit others and save them from suffering. And those actions will thereby affect your heart. In addition, you should pray for the relief of the pain of others, even if the words do not come from your heart, even if the one who is suffering is simple, common, or lowly. Says the Chazon Ish, if you're not an empathetic person, you need to work on yourself. If you hear someone suffering, and your first instinct, your intuition is not to say, what can I do? How can I make it better? Then you need to work on yourself. Not just, I remain the cold, cruel, withdrawn, insensitive person, and I do the mitzvah, but how can I become the mitzvah? How can I become in the image of God, Mahu Rachum Avatar Rachum? How can you cultivate and refine yourself to be a good friend? To not think about yourself like Hagar and look away, but to say, I can't look away because I care so much, because I connect so much, because I am in such pain. In the 10 plagues, one of the biggest plagues, Source 14, Parshas Bo, one of the biggest plagues, Lo ro isha sachiv lo kamu ish mitachtav shloshes yamim lechol bnei Yisrael hayor b'moshvosam. Was the plague of Choshech, the plague of darkness. For 3 days it says, Lo ra'u isha sachiv. The Chidush Arim, the first Ger Rebbe, says, you know what this plague was? What, the sun didn't come up that day? Was the cloud cover so thick? What does it mean there was such darkness? And the Chidush Arim explains, you know what it means there was darkness? Just look at the pasuk, it explains. The darkness was, Lo ra'u ish es achiv. The darkness was that one person could not see the other. When you are so narcissistic, so self-centered, so egocentric, that all you care about is your pleasure and your happiness and your life and how well or not well things are going for you, you are cloaked in darkness. You are stuck in a dungeon. You are living a very dark world. And nobody wants to be near you or connected to you. The plague of darkness was that the Egyptians didn't care about one another. Lo ra'u isha sachiv, they couldn't see one another. They didn't feel the pain of one another. But l'chol Yisrael ya'or b'moshvasam, for the Jewish people, they had tremendous light in their dwelling places. Among the Chazon Ish's things he said to feel, if we are to feel a sense of empathy for others, is also to be moved to pray for people. Right? So empathy demands that I hear you're sick, I can't help but bring you something to eat, ask you if we could drive carpool, what can I do to help? Text you 5 times a day, want you to know I'm thinking about you. That's empathy. But on the list of things to do for empathy, and the Chazon Ish's formula or prescription for how to become a person of empathy is also to pray. So Source 16 is the Sha'arim B'Tfilah of Shimshon David Pinkus. We just wrapped up on Wednesday mornings going through the whole Sefer. It's all online on YUTorah, an amazing, amazing, amazing Sefer. And he writes the following. I'll tell it to you outside because we're going to run out of time. He says, you know, imagine a friend comes to you and says, unfortunately, my wife was diagnosed with a horrific illness and we have our local doctors, but we're trying to get into this amazing mumcha, this great doctor. You know, last year, I went to visit several times a young girl who was in Sloan Kettering Hospital getting treatment. And the first time I went, I noticed the whole floor that this teenage girl was on, the Hasidim, from people, like the whole floor was from Jews. So I said to the father of this girl, right, to the point I want you to know that it was a Wednesday, and when I left, the African-American nurse at the nurse's station said to me, good Shabbos, it's Wednesday, so I'm allowed to start saying that, right? That's how well she was trained in the proper greetings. So I said to the father of this girl, what's the deal? Like, do from people get disproportional children cancer than anyone else? He said, no. The deal is that everyone else is satisfied going to their local hospital. From Jews are not, don't settle till they get into Sloan Kettering. It's a fascinating thing, right? I don't know if that bodes well for how the rest of the world looks at us, but we're not satisfied with the local whatever. We do whatever it takes to get into Sloan Kettering, and that's why disproportionately the whole place is from. So imagine someone calls and says, I know that you're good friends, you were college roommates with the world's expert in X. Could you help me get in for my wife, for my child? So if you say no, then one of two things is true. Either you're not really close with that doctor, or you don't really feel close with the person who asked. One of those two things is true. They can't both not be true, and yet you refrain from asking. Because if you're a good friend to the person who petitioned you, and you have the connection, you would ask. So one of those two things has to be true. So Rav Pinkus says, you know, if you believe in God, if you feel you're a child of the Almighty, that He's our shepherd and we're His flock, if you love God and you relate to Him and you have an access to Him, and you love whoever you know who's in pain, if you don't ask God to intercede and help, then one of two things is true. Either you don't really feel connected to God or you don't feel connected to this person. But you can't claim to both feel connected to God and that He's the source of all existence, of all power, of all that happens. He has dominion and providence over the world. And at the same time, feel close to the person who's in pain. So Pinkus basically says that if you feel empathy, if you're a caring person, then on the checklist of things to do, offer to drive carpool, drop off dinner, text for no reason at all, and oh yeah, daven for them. Daven for them. You think God is less critical than the expert doctor they're going to, or having the best lawyer, or needing the best accountant, or whatever the case may be? God is the source of all things. And we have an audience with Him whenever we want it. How could we not take advantage of it? To the point that Pinkus describes, if you even hear someone's in pain to the extent that you see, you come across, you read in the newspaper, you got an email chain, or you saw on Facebook, today a security guard in Israel, I think a soldier, outside the Tachanah Merkazit was stabbed. Rahman al-Islam, and severely injured. There's a whole a horrific video to watch, actually. Thanks to security cameras, we can now see terror events afterwards, so that we could just become insensitized to them. But anyway, so how could you watch that video, which I made the mistake of doing, how could you see that and not say one moment, Ribono Shel Olam, give him a refuah shleima, give him the strength, give his family the strength to help him through it. If you don't respond to watching that video or seeing that headline by asking Hashem to help, one of two things is true. Either you don't really care about this precious neshama, or you don't believe that God has the power to help. But if you believe God is God and you feel for that person, you'll take a moment. My sister-in-law in Israel, I don't know if she still does it, I remember she did. Every time she heard a siren, she said a perek of Tehillim. When she heard an ambulance, she said a perek of Tehillim. She had no idea what it meant, but it didn't mean something good. They likely were not going to deliver good news. Maybe deliver a baby, but that too needs a perek of Tehillim. So she would mumble a perek of Tehillim quickly every second, every time she heard a siren in Yerushalayim. Not the siren of the rockets, ambulance or emergency siren. So on our checklist, if we are people of feeling and people of empathy, is to intercede, is to daven, is to care. It's what it means to be a leader. It's what it means to be nosei ba'ol im chavero. Now this is true on the communal level, and this is the point made by Irving Bunin in his book on Pirkei Avos in Source 17. On this Mishnah, that one of the 48 prerequisites to be a Torah person is to feel empathy, is to carry the burden with another. He says, if you care about the community, you got to get involved in the community. You can't complain that the mikvah is old and needs to be redone and not step forward and say, what can I do to help improve the mikvah? You can't say, you know, so-and-so was neglected, they need chesed meals, and you're not on the list of people making chesed meals. You can't care about the sisterhood, can't care about the shul, the school, the PTA, the PTO, whatever initials or acronyms. You can't criticize and claim to care and not be willing to step up. Nosei ba'ol means that you want to carry the burden. You want to make it lighter for others. Why should the same people be crushed under the burden of the communal obligations over and over, and nobody's lifting it? Nobody's trying to help them. They're being crushed underneath that burden, and nobody's lifting it with them to make it a little bit lighter. That's our responsibility. Our responsibility is to make it a little lighter. Okay, so I want to show you this short video for 3 seconds. Already, and I want to give now practical suggestions of what does it mean to be a Torah personality who is nosei ba'ol. What does it mean to be the type of person who feels the pain of another? This is the greatest definition of the difference between sympathy and empathy I ever saw.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy. Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
You see why I was desperately trying to figure out how to show you that video on Simple Story. Sorry. So the point she makes in this video, and you can follow her readings also. I actually have a summary of this on page 12, Brené Brown on empathy versus sympathy. But it's so critically important, because while we all laughed at her at least comments, those at least comments happen all the time. They may not begin with the words at least, but some form of that happen all the time. You know, you pay a shiva call. Well, they lived a long life. You know, I know somebody who had that illness and died so much earlier. At least they didn't suffer. At least they didn't this. You know, and where does it come from? Because I just want to make this very clear. The people who say the stupidest things, of which now people have begun to formulate lists of the stupidest things said at Shiva, the stupidest things said for divorce, the stupidest said things there. So all of those individuals authoring those ridiculously stupid comments, where does it come from? It's not malice. It's not malice. It's not coming from someone saying, let me figure out how to hurt Dvor Orlin. It doesn't come from someone saying, let me figure out how to cause enormous pain to someone. You know where it comes from? It comes from not knowing what to say. It comes from having nothing to say. So one of the most important things to understand about empathy that Brené Brown just taught us, but was taught much earlier on in Sefer Iyov. When Iyov's friends come to sit with him, nobody we know who suffered has suffered more than Iyov. Right? Nobody more. Iyov's whole book is the book of suffering, Job. And when his friends come sit with him, what do? They sit in silence. Because what they're communicating is, you're not alone, right? In her imagery, I'm down in the dungeon sitting next to you. I'm not peering down the hole saying, wow, it looks pretty dark and cold and terrible down there. I actually climb down the ladder and I'm sitting there with you. And I'm holding your hand, or I'm just in the room. I've sat next to people while they were getting chemo. And I had a book open or a laptop doing work, and their eyes were closed or even open. And it doesn't matter that there's no... We said, what a waste of time. I wasn't even talking. I wasn't even communicating. I wasn't even making them feel better. No. It was the most incredible use of time, because just being present can relieve a person of their pain and of their suffering. and certainly is far better than the at least statements. The person who's struggling doesn't need judgment. They don't need to be told how to feel. They don't need to be told why they should be grateful that at least. What they need is to know that you're down in the dungeon. That's empathy. Sympathy is better than insensitivity, but better than sympathy, at least, is a sense of empathy. And if you think it has no value, I want to show you the incredible value that it does have. And I know I'm running late, but too bad. Give me two more minutes. The Gemara Bava Metzia in Source 20 tells us that when you visit a sick person, you take away 1/60th of their illness. The Gemara says you visit a sick person, you take away 1/60th of their illness, which always caused me to think, why don't we just set up 60 visits back to back and make the person better? But it doesn't work that way. So what does it mean that you make them a little better? You take away 1/60th. It's just like a nice idea, you take it a little better. So look at this story. Jerome Groopman, who is actually Yocheved's father's cousin. Jerome Groopman is a New York Times bestselling author. He's a Harvard doctor. He's a Harvard professor. He's a best-selling author. He's an incredible individual. It's worth reading his many, many, many books. And he has one book called The Anatomy of Hope. And in his book, The Anatomy of Hope, he tells this incredible story. Barbara received another 3 courses of chemotherapy. The tumor seemed to shrug off the drugs. The deposits grew in her liver and her bones. She lost weight. She spent most of the time in bed. After the last cycle of chemo, I admitted her to the hospital with a high fever. Antibiotics stemmed an early bacterial infection. As Barbara slowly recovered from the infection, I told myself I knew of no drugs, standard or experimental, that stood a real chance of ameliorating her condition. The time had come for me to tell her. I chose to visit her in the early evening when the hubbub of the hospital had settled down, so there'd be less chance of distraction and interruption. Barbara greeted me warmly, as she always did. I moved a chair closer to the bedside and grasped her hand. You see, he's an extraordinary doctor. This is not an ordinary doctor. You understand what Dr. Groopman did? He didn't say what's most convenient for me in my rounds and my office visits and with my family to visit her. He said, what will be best for her, for me to visit her to tell her this news? I don't need someone to come take some blood or check her blood pressure or have her roommate's family visit while I'm telling her this news. Just alone, he was sensitive enough to calculate what would be the best time for her for me to visit. And then he pulled the chair close to her. Not as if your cancer is contagious, I need to move away, but he pulled the chair close to her. A lot of people go through their very difficult times, and they feel, again, that intense loneliness is the result of people making them feel that whatever they're going through is contagious. How many people who have an ill spouse and become the primary caretaker, their friends drop off the planet? Just when they need to be offered, you know, take a night out, the home health aide is there, come out for a cup of coffee, you need it. Or let me come to you and bring you coffee, because you need it. But if people have this attitude as if her spouse is dying, well, if I'm close to her, then it's going to happen to my spouse. They act irrationally as if it's contagious. And instead of being like Aaron to say, I need to look, I can't look away, they're like Hagar. You know what? It's too sad. I'm in retirement. I'm in the prime of my life. I want to relax. I don't need her troubles. I don't want his problems. It's not my problem. Those are not Torah personalities. They're missing this quality of nose ba'olam chavero. Like Dr. Groopman, to be a good friend of someone in crisis is to not be able to look away, to be able to have to always be involved. So he calculates, when is the best time for her? And then he pulls her chair closer to say, I'm not afraid that I'm gonna contract this cancer from you. And he even holds her hand, which is a very powerful message of being together. And he writes, Barbara greeted me warmly, she always did. She returned the gesture, but had little force. After we chatted for a short time about several articles in the day's newspaper, I began to break the bad news. Barbara, we've known each other for well over a year, and we've been honest with each other every step of the way. Briefly, her lips trembled, and then she regained her composure. Her eyes told me she knew what I was about to say. And then Jerome, Dr. Groopman, says what he told her. I know of no medicines that I can give at this point to help you. We sat in heavy silence. Barbara shook her head. No, Jerry, she said. You do have something to give. You have the medicine of friendship. Wow. And I saw that and I thought of this Gemara Bava Metzia. Every time we visit someone, we're giving them a dose of medicine. It's not Oxycontin or morphine or ibuprofen, but we're taking away 1/60th of their illness. That friendship is a dose of medicine. It is a form of medicine. To not be alone, to have companionship, camaraderie, support, for you to say, I'm holding you up so that your burden is a little lighter, is a dose of medicine. A couple of the points very, very quickly, and I promise I'm ending. Page 13, source 22. I've shared this before, an amazing article. Read it on your own. It's called The Ring Theory of Comfort. The ring theory of comfort, Susan Silk, a result of her research. She says, in life you got to draw concentric rings. The center of the circle, the nucleus of all the rings, is the person going through the crisis. So we all know someone, we all have a dear friend who's gone through a crisis, an unimaginable loss of a child, a terrible, terrible diagnosis. They are the center of that circle. The first circle around them, the first circle is the one around them, is a spouse and children, the nuclear family. The next circle are brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces and cousins. The next circle are the closest friends. The next circle are acquaintances. The next circle are community members. Draw the circles however you want. The nucleus is the person in crisis, and then there are concentric circles. And what we tend to do is, we think we're making someone feel better, maybe we're making ourselves feel better, by saying what we began with. We tell someone inside the circle, I can't bear to look at you this way. I can't bear to see your husband, your wife that way. So Susan Silk came up with this theory, that you comfort in and you dump out. Whichever circle you're in, you're a family member, you're a friend, you're an acquaintance, you're a business associate, you're a community member, or you just read about the person on Facebook. You can only comfort in, you can't dump in. You save your dumping for out. So you had a horrible visit with that person. You don't tell that to the spouse or children. You dump out. You can only dump to somebody who's in one of the outer rings than yours. When it comes to the inner rings, you only offer comfort. Comfort in, dump out. It's an incredible visual way to picture how to set up this relationship. I end with Sheryl Sandberg, option B. Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, an amazingly accomplished woman, suffered a horrific tragedy a couple of years ago. She was away on a business trip. She's on the beach with her husband. He says, I want to work out in the gym. She says, great, I'll meet you at dinner. They make the time for dinner. She goes back to the room to get ready. He's not there. She assumes he already showered. She comes down to dinner. She's sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. He's not there. She tries to call him. There's no answer. She retraces the steps and she realizes the last thing he said was he was going to work out in the gym. So she makes her way to the gym in this resort. And in the gym, she opens the door and she finds him next to the treadmill on the ground. He had passed away suddenly. So beyond tragic, she has to fly home, tell her children, rebuild her life on a moment's notice. He himself, a very successful entrepreneur, CEO of SurveyMonkey, and what a horrific, horrific tragedy. So she wrote a book with another great writer, Adam Grant, called Option B. When option A of life is taken away from you, how do you turn to option B? It's a book about resiliency. It's a book about coming back. But I believe it's a book that should be mandatory reading for every smicha student. I think it's a book that should be mandatory reading for every caring person. Because in it, she talks about her experiences of the stupidest things people said and did and the most helpful things that people said and did. So let's look at a couple of them quickly. It's page 14, number 23. My message began by describing the void and how easy it was to get sucked in. I said, for the first time ever, I understood the power of prayer. Let me not die while I'm still alive. Grasping for a lifeline, I wrote about how I wanted to choose meaning over emptiness. I thanked my family and friends who had helped me through. She's talking about a Facebook post she wrote on the shloshim of the loss of her husband, Dave. She wrote a post to mark his shloshim. She's a traditional woman. Actually, a woman in our community was her preschool teacher and still has a relationship. Simcha Firestone's mother. And she wrote the shloshim post to mark it, and she references it here in the book. But she writes, then I did what proved so difficult to do with friends and colleagues face to face. I described how a casual greeting like, how are you, hurt because it didn't acknowledge anything out of the ordinary had happened. I pointed out that if people instead asked, how are you today, it showed that they were aware that I was struggling to get through each day. I read this, I changed my entire practice. You don't say to someone, how are you? How are you? How are you? You put on that Nebuch voice, right? Everyone has that Nebuch voice. How are you? How are you doing? How are you? I mean, how am I? How could I be? So how are you today is an implicit acknowledgement that every day stinks. How are you getting through today? How are you this hour? How are you this minute? It is an implicit acknowledgement just by adding that word, today. How are you today? She continued, cancer is another forbidden or whisper topic. I read about a writer, Emily McDowell, who said the worst part of being diagnosed with lymphoma wasn't feeling sick from chemo or losing hair. It was the loneliness and isolation I felt when many of my close friends and family members disappeared. They didn't know what to say. Or they said the wrong thing without realizing it. So she wrote empathy cards. I love them all, but these are two of my favorites, she writes, and she published them in the book. When life gives you lemons, I won't tell you a story about my cousin's friend who died of lemons. I'm really sorry I haven't been in touch. I didn't know what to say. She continued, this is the last page. When I first read Emily's cards, I thought back to a friend with late-stage cancer telling me that for him, the worst thing people could say was, it's going to be okay. He said the terrified voice in his head would wonder, how do you know it's going to be okay? Don't you understand that I might die? I remember the year before Dave died, when a friend of mine was diagnosed with cancer. At the time, I thought the best way to offer comfort was to assure her, you'll be okay, I just know it. Then I dropped the subject for weeks, thinking she would raise it again if she wanted to. I meant well then, but I know better now. Recently, a work colleague was diagnosed, and I handled it differently. I told her, I know you don't know yet what will happen. I know you don't know yet what will happen, and neither do I. But you won't go through this alone. I will be there with you every step of the way. By saying this, I acknowledge that she was in a stressful and scary situation. I then continue to check in with her regularly. The gift of this book is it gives us a vocabulary. Literally, put the scripts in your cell phone, so when you encounter people you are to be close friends with, you don't say the stupid things. She's giving us the vocabulary and the script to say smart things. I don't know what will happen. I know you don't know, and neither do I, but I will be with you every step of the way. And by the way, if you make that promise, you can't say it and disappear. If you make the promise, you better mean it, and you better follow through on it. And gives more. The last thing is on the right. Author Bruce Feiler believes the problem lies in the offer to do anything. He writes, while well-meaning, this gesture unintentionally shifts the obligation. We all do that, right? You heard someone had a horrible thing, so you send a text. Is there anything I can do for you? Very rare is the person who says, as a matter of fact, there is. Most people feel awkward. We want to feel independent. You don't want to feel pathetic in a nebuch. So you say, no, all good. And then you lie there hungry and your children have nothing to eat and no way to get home from school because you didn't want to say, yes, there was something you can do. So she talks about that instead of saying, is there anything I can do, just do something. Bruce points to friends who sent packing supplies to someone who was moving out after getting divorced, others who held a fire shower, a variation of a bridal shower for a friend who lost her home. Dan Levy told me when his son got sick, he was by her side, a friend texted him, what do you not want on a burger? Dan appreciated the effort. Instead of asking me if I wanted food, he made the choice for me, but gave me the dignity of feeling in control. Right? Because I read this, last week somebody I know's child had some minor surgery, so I sent a text saying, do your children prefer milkshakes or fleishigs for dinner? I didn't say, do you need dinner? Do your children prefer milkshakes or fleishigs? And then you have to make whichever one they answer and bring it over. So I send the text. Another friend, Dan, was available for a hug if needed one and would be in the hospital lobby for the next hour, whether she came downstairs or not. You get the gist, and I hope you'll get the book, because in place of the silly things we say because we don't know what to say, there are smart things to say and to do. And so we all have friends who are in crisis, minor or major. There are better things that we can do as friends. Hopefully, if we can cultivate the sense of empathy within us, we can unburden our friends, carry it with them, so it becomes just a little bit lighter. Thank you.